Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Maria de Mergis.
I'm Zsolt Darvas.
And I am Carlo Altomonte.
And in this episode, we will get back to a conversation that we have started at Bruegel almost a year ago when the COVID-19 pandemic kicked in. And it is the economic policy, and more precisely, the fiscal response at national level, first to face the ongoing crisis, secondly, to plan the recovery. Discussions around the economic stimulus that should be set in motion for the recovery are very much hot in the United States at the moment, with the Biden administration announcing $1.9 trillion recovery package. On our side of the pond, the EU member states have been discussing about the recovery plan since last spring, and over the summer they struck a political deal to create a 750 billion euro pandemic recovery fund. Hard-pressed EU capitals must now submit detailed plans to Brussels to unlock their share of the cash and begin rebooting their economies. On this week, on the 9th February specifically, the European Parliament has been discussing the regulation establishing the Recovery and Resilience Facility, which is the main engine of the recovery fund. The RFF puts the European Commission in a strikingly powerful position. Brussels is the arbiter of the initial plans and will for year police governments, as disbursement will only be dished out when countries hit agreed milestones. To date, 18 member states have shared draft plans with the Commission, while another 6 have sent in substantial chunks of their plans. 3 have yet to put draft forwards. And these plans will need to meet the Commission's approval before being voted through by the EU 27 capitals. We have also seen how the stakes around these plans are high. In Italy, for example, the government has fallen over disagreements on the recovery plan, and it is heading towards a new government headed by Mario Draghi. We're going to zoom in the hot Italian case later on, but let's first recap for our listeners where do we stand so far with the national measures. I am looking at Zsolt because you have been monitoring the national fiscal response and published a dataset freely available on the Bruegel website, and for our listeners, they can access it to the link which is in the show notes. And I would like to ask Zsolt, because he has been monitoring this since the very beginning, what has been your assessment so far of the first fiscal response at national level of the European countries that you have been monitoring?
When the pandemic hit the European Union, it came largely as a surprise. Nobody foresee even already in December 2019 that from China, the COVID-19 pandemic would spread to Europe in such a great extent. So when it hit initially in February and March last year, governments were very quickly, it was a surprise to them, but at the same time, they started to respond very, very early on by passing supplementary budgets to help, first of all, the healthcare system. So quite some money were allocated to the healthcare system for workers, for equipment, and for many related measures. But then also it turned out very soon that it would have a major negative impact on the economy. And governments started to approve various kinds of support measures. I think one of the most important type of measures, which was a distinct feature this time, is employment protection schemes, whereby the government essentially subsidized wages in private firms. So the idea behind that was that if firms do not lay off their employees, then they get, let's say, 80% of the wages from the government. So certainly this is good for the individuals because they were not laid off. They were at home and, reading books or doing whatever they could do in their isolation. But at least they had a work contract and they knew that whenever the social distancing rules will be weakened and their employer will start to produce more goods or services, they can immediately go back to their office. You know, they receive a phone call that please come tomorrow at 8 in the office and they can be there. It's also good for the company, because sort of their qualified employees were still on their contract. So they didn't have to lay off, which is certainly a difficult process. And then they didn't have to rehire, because, you know, if they start to hire workers at the time when the economy restarts, you know, they have to select. It takes a lot of time. Then when they hire the new people, they have to learn all the procedures and processes within the company. So it's a lot of time and difficulties. But if they can call on just their previous workers, who knows all the processes, they can take up the work immediately. So in my view, these labor protection schemes were one of the most important measures that were adopted in practically every European Union country. And it was a very distinctive feature, because there was a similar scheme in Germany, and also there were some similar schemes in some other countries, a much lower scale before. But this time it was really a massive, and, you know, in some countries, almost one quarter of the total population were under such schemes that helped to protect the labor force. In addition to that, there were also many other supports to household, to small and medium enterprises, sometimes also to big firms. Also later on, government started to do more public investment. There was also several tax measures, a lot of tax deferrals. So companies which face revenue losses, they could defer payment of taxes, which provided liquidity, but also some taxes were actually cut. So there were many different types of measures. There were also a lot of loans and guarantees, whereby, for example, the government guaranteed new loans which were granted by banks. Because, you know, at a time of high uncertainty, which was the case last year, and to some extent this is still the case, you know, banks are more reluctant to grant new loans to companies, because they fear that, you know, nobody knows whether the company will go bankrupt or not as a result of the economic losses. But if, you know, the government offers a guarantee, let's say, to 80% of the loan, then banks are more incentivized to provide loans. So I think all of these guarantees were also very useful. And in the data set that we kindly introduced, we tried to measure all of these measures one by one, so a kind of bottom-up approach. So we looked at each individual measure and added up them. And if I can just say a few words about a cross-country comparison, we looked at about 10 European countries plus the United Kingdom and the United States. And what we found is that certainly the United States provided the largest fiscal stimulus. But we also have to see it in light of the general welfare system of a country. Because, for example, in the European Union, we have a very, you know, large welfare system, unemployment benefits, and many other different kinds of benefits. So even if in the absence of any discretionary fiscal policy, these already existing benefits and instruments help people, help companies. But in the US, this so-called safety net is much weaker. So in the US, it was quite natural, in my view, that they provided a larger fiscal stimulus than European Union countries. Just for example, if you look at the generosity of unemployment benefit schemes, in Europe, they are much more generous than in the United States. So indeed, in the US, they had to provide more. If you look at European Union countries and make a comparison, then we see that there was also some differentiations according to the public debts that countries have. For example, Spain and Italy have higher public debts, let's say, than Germany and Denmark. And that we found that Spain and Italy provided a lower fiscal stimulus than Germany and Denmark. And certainly we can just speculate about the reasons, but in my view, it might relate that Spanish and Italian policymakers were more cautious because they already had a higher public debt. These countries are also depend more on tourism than, let's say, Germany, so they were also harder hit. So they were probably there was some cautious approach to fiscal policy making. So in this sense, it's especially welcome that there was this European-wide agreement on Next Generation EU, and within that, the Recovery and Resilience Facility, which aims to support member states which are hit harder, including Spain and Italy. So at least this European support certainly cannot fully compensate the differences. What is, let's say, there between Germany and Italy, but at least it helps a little. So I'm generally positive about the European response, and in particular, this Next Generation EU instrument.
And we are going to zoom in the next generation EU in a few minutes. But before, I would like to ask Maria and Carlo if they have some comments about this overview that that Scholt provided related to this emergency response.
Yeah, if I may, I'll add perhaps a couple of points to what Scholt described, which was quite comprehensive in terms of what happened. I think perhaps for the benefit of our listeners as well, an interesting comparison is always the fiscal stimulus that was given in the EU versus the fiscal stimulus that was given in the US. I think that's kind of an interesting thing. And as of Scholt said, the fiscal stimulus in the US was bigger. And apart from the argument that he made on the welfare side, there is also another important difference that I would note without necessarily knowing which one is better. And that is that, as Scholt said, the philosophy behind the protecting the workers is very much to keep people in employment. So the support was there to help the firms sustain employment. By contrast, in the US, the fiscal support that came to support employment was done in the form of unemployment benefits. So people were laid off and then the government provided the necessary unemployment benefits. So one system aimed to keep people in employment, the other aimed to keep people basically sustaining their consumption through an appropriate consumption bundle in the form of unemployment benefit. Now, so you saw that the US was bigger, but did not preserve employment, whereas in Europe preserved employment, but smaller package. Now, I think the jury's still out. I think ex-ante, we could probably argue that it's better, also for psychological reasons, to keep people in employment. But, you know, we need to know how well this will work out once and when we come out of this pandemic, when we have a better picture in terms of the preservation of productivity and productive value. So I would personally reserve judgment when it comes to sort of comparing the choice between the US and the EU. Then on the other small point I wanted to make, which I think is probably true, is that there has been a lot of discussion in the EU as to whether the support that was given at the country level was a direct function of the fiscal space that countries had. And of course, that's common sense, and Scholt made this point as well. And it is also true that it was a direct function of the space that countries had. However, in a paper that some of my colleagues at Bruegelmeier will very soon publish, they're actually try and dig deeper and understand whether some of the guarantees that the government made available were necessarily taken up as a result of being more of them. So countries that provided guarantees, did companies actually utilize those guarantees? And they find that actually the differences are actually not that big, irrespective of the size of the guarantees that countries gave. In other words, they find that fiscal space hasn't been really a constraint in terms of companies picking up, of calling up the funds that were provided to them. So we are not out of the woods yet. So we will have to still, I think, count, and I think that will take us also to the next point of the conversation, still have to count on fiscal support for some time to come. And how this will evolve, of course, is difficult to guess right now.
Indeed, we are not out of the woods yet, and we are still in this crisis situation. And Carlo, what is your take on those measures that have been so far implemented at national level?
Well, I think, as Scholt said, they were absolutely necessary. They were timely, and they were similar across all EU countries, which in a way makes sense if you think that now we have a single market with a single currency, and we probably start sharing also some social features together. I also would like to reinstate the fact that comparison between the EU and US are hard to make because of the different, of course, welfare systems and the automatic stabilizers that operate in Europe while they do not, or operate to a lesser extent in the US. So discretionary spending has to be higher in the US to guarantee the same level of protection. And also do not underestimate the fundamental different ways through which companies finance themselves. Most of the financing, the external financing in Europe is done through banks, so bank loans, versus the market in the US. So that explains why the point that Maria was reinstating in this forthcoming Bruegel publication, that the part of the fiscal response, and Scholt also mentioned this, came through guarantees that the governments have put in place in order to guarantee loans to banks. If you take those guarantees into account, Italy has, for example, guaranteed, and also Germany, up to 30% of the Italian GDP and the German GDP are gone in guarantees. So if you take those into account, that would be a massive stimulus. Of course, you cannot be sure, and you wish that these guarantees will never be used, because that means that the companies do not go bankrupt. We start having some estimates of to the extent to which these guarantees might be exerted, and they are not worrisome. because, of course, a fraction of these companies sooner or later will have to default. And this opens the second point I would like to make, which is the phasing out of these strategies once the crisis starts to get over. So we have to phase out the job retention schemes. So we start to have companies fully paying the wages of workers without having the state support. And we have to allow companies to go bankrupt, essentially, which is something we are preventing in so far. If you look at the statistics on bankruptcies across Europe from one year to the other, there is a drastic drop, like no one is going bankrupt because actually by law, it's impossible to go bankrupt because you have all these tax reliefs and all these sort of relief measures and guarantees on loans that allow you to stay in place. So at a certain moment, however, we will have to discriminate those companies that have to go out because they have run out of business and they have no steam anymore. And those companies that instead still require for a number of months or years help in order to get out of the woods. There will be a very, very delicate balance to strike in phasing out the measures and start, allowing for that type of reallocation of economic activities, which is a fundamental driver of productivity growth. If we get this wrong, we risk of having a large swath of zombie companies, and we know that these zombie firms then will translate into zombie banks. We end in Japan scenario. If we get it the other way, too sudden phase out, we will risk of throwing away the baby with the dirty water. So companies that should be save the book of bankrupt because of lack of steam, of support. So this next phase in Europe is going to be very delicate, and we have to start thinking about this. Of course, the recovery fund helps a lot. Just to give statistics, the recovery fund that has been approved by Europe, not by chance, talks about recovery and resilience, i.e. being able to stimulate through reforms, not only investment, the productivity growth that is necessary for those, the economic system to continue. And just to give a number, the recovery plan is 5 times larger than the Marshall Plan that the US had put into Europe after World War II. So this is a massive effort that the European Union is making, and I wish the plan all the success. Of course, as we know, and we will explore together, there are a number of things that we still have to clarify.
Yes, indeed. And Carlo, what you pointed out at the very end of your comment, the fact that we are going to be in a really pivotal moment for national economies and the European economy as well, in order to try to understand what is the future direction of the recovery, the future direction of the sustainability. You mentioned the word resilience, it is a little bit of a mantra. And on this, perhaps also to explain to our listeners a bit better, and I look at Maria here, maybe we should go back a bit on the actual recovery plan and what has been decided, because there is the seed not only of the money but also of the direction that the European Union would like the economy to go once that the emergency phase is finished.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just say a few introductory remarks on this by picking up also from what Carlo said on the resilience, because I think that word is critical on the way that the fund was designed. I remind our listeners that this is, by coincidence, is the year that we negotiated the new budget, the EU budget, which is on a 7-year plan, on a 7-year cycle, so this year for another 7 years. And it is of the order of magnitude of around 1.1 trillion euros. That's the amount of money that will go from Europe directly to the countries in the next 7 years, and it will be allotted in certain proportions every year. On top of that, then, as a result of the pandemic crisis, then, and in view of increasing the resilience of the EU, we put up jointly an extra 750 billion, brought it up to 1.8 trillion together for another 7 years, which is now extra funds that will help deal basically with the pandemic. And what's interesting about that, and here comes the resilience part, is the fact that this will be financed by EU debt. So, the EU for the first time will go out and borrow for a very big amount. And half of that borrowing, more or less, will be given to countries as grants. And half of it, more or less, a little bit more, will be given in the form of loans. But what's interesting about the resilience and why I want to emphasize that is because it is jointly issued. It is debt that we all kind of issue together and therefore share the risk of doing that. There are, of course, countries that will benefit a lot more than others because the recovery fund is very much designed with the idea of helping those countries that are both hit much bigger by the shock economically, but also health-wise, because, you know, the cost in terms of human lives and you know, the pandemic itself has been quite different in some countries. So that's very much the idea behind that. Now, the question is, how are we going to spend this money? And this is now, if you like, the $1 million question, and why countries have put up what you call the plans, the recovery plans that need to be approved. If we are going to issue joint debt, then I think countries have the right to also have a word in how others are spending that money. I think that's very much the rationale behind the governance structure behind the recovery fund.
Yeah, Zsolt, you are also monitoring now, after this biggest exercise that you made on monitoring the fiscal response of the in the emergency situation, you are starting to study as well what is going on in the different countries about the recovery plans, right?
Indeed. We are setting up a new data set in which we summarize the various measures in the national recovery and resilience plans. Now, it's a very delicate and difficult job, because in national ministries, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of people working on all of these details of these plans for several months. And, you know, we are certainly not able to evaluate, for example, whether improving the sewage system in a rural area in Bulgaria is a good project, or instead they should have deployed, you know, more solar panels, or, I mean, improve or introduce measures supporting productivity. So commenting on the content of the plans is very difficult, but at least what we try is to make some cross-country comparisons on what member states plan to spend their money. I mean, there are quite some guidelines by the Commission on what they should spend the money. I mean, it was agreed that at least 37% of all the money should go for green investments and related reforms. And another additional 20% should go for digital investments and related reforms. Now, certainly countries can do more in these two major flagship areas, but these are the minimum values. And I mean, they are also supposed to respond to these so-called country-specific recommendations that each member state receive in the context of the European semester, which is this annual economic policy coordination exercise in the EU. This European semester ends in every summer by country-specific recommendations that member states aim to do. Our earlier research found that member states are not really eager to implement these recommendations. They are doing less than half of them, or even less than a third of them. But now that the money is partially tied to the implementation of these reforms, we might see a higher chance of implementation of these country-specific recommendations by the European semester.
Of course, Zsolt, you are not in the position yet to give a deep analysis of each of the plans and how they compare, as you mentioned. But I would like to take the chance of the fact that we have Carlo, who is sitting in Milan and has been closely following the whole situation and the whole discussions on the recovery plan in Italy. And as I recalled at the beginning of this episode, they have had quite heavy political repercussion, meaning that the previous government failed discussing the recovery plan. So it's a very much a hot topic in Italy and beyond, because of course the success of the recovery plan in Italy would mean also certain things for the rest of the European Union and for the success of this whole operation and the overall recovery of the economy after the pandemic. So would like to ask you a bit your take on Italy, and also exactly for the reasons that Zsolt explained, that it's not super immediate to grasp the scope of what is going on a national level. Use also the Italian case as a case study for the broader discussion we are having, not just to get to know more about the specific country itself, which of course we are very interested in.
No, thank you. I mean, as you correctly said, Giuseppe, the Italian government, the previous government fell on precisely on that thing that Zsolt mentioned, that how tricky it is to tie reforms to spending. And the previous government coalition lacked enough political willingness or political agreement or political capital, call it the way you want, to implement the very let's say, deep structural reforms that are necessary for the success of the Italian plan. In particular, two of them have been required by the European Commission and are seen as instrumental for the success of the plan. That is the reform of the civil justice system, so shortening the delays that we have in civil courts, so business, essentially the business business law, and simplifying this type of procedures, so that to give more certainty to any sort of juridical problem that might arise between legal counterparts in executing contracts. This rule of law indicator is one of the key driver of competitiveness, and Italy has always lagging behind into this. It's more of an organizational matter, really, in terms of processes that have to be implemented into civil courts rather than having to spend a lot. So it's just digitalizing important parts of the system and reorganizing process, the workflow of these courts. But it has to be done, and clearly there is an internal opposition by part of the judicial system to go in that direction. And the other related is the reform of the public administration, simplifying bureaucracy, cutting red tape, start crossing data, digitalizing data and crossing them, which, by the way, is one also the reason why Italy had such a high death rate in COVID, because we were partly unable to track contagion rates and to link these contagions to the local healthcare hospitals and physicians that could help families. So this is also, you know, a good example of why we need this. So these are the two overarching reforms that we need to implement. And then more in general, we need to, and this is a key characteristic of all the plans in Europe, I think, it is very important to understand that why the Commission wants everyone to go more or less in the same direction in the environmental or in the digital economy, because the recovery plan is meant to, let's say, help everyone and make Europe, let's say, more productive and grow more in the future. The European Commission has identified the areas of sustainability and the digital economy as key drivers of productivity in the future. And of course, if they are allocating common money, common debt, as Maria was saying, to countries, they don't want then every country to go in their own direction. They want everyone to row more or less in the same direction. The boat has to go more or less in the same direction. So they are putting some constraints on the general direction of which this money has to go. Now, coming back to the Italian example, clearly the Italian plan allocates 37%, even 40% of money to the sustainable economy, sustainability issues, hydrogen, renewables, 23% to the digital economy, 5G, and the creation of digital fiber throughout the entire country. But then what he was lacking was the reforms associated to this. Say you want to create a new hydrogen industry in your country. Well, you have to do so by, first of all, let's say, coordinating this industry with the existing energy sources, traditional fuel providers. The renewables, solar and wind, are very important in Italy. The grid, the network grid of energy that you have to connect to. Hydrogen is irrelevant if then you use it for public transport, for example, but then it implies that you have to modify public transport law in every region in the country. And then it also, hydrogen can be used for transport, so let's say transport by truck rather versus transport by train, which also implies a reform of the transport strategy of the country. The same is true for digital. Say you want to do 5G and fiber, but then here in Italy we have a strong incumbent, which is Telecom Italia, which is now integrating also the infrastructure, while the Commission is saying that the infrastructure should be partly split by the vertical integrator, so we need to reform also this. As you see, every moment we put on the table an investment, there is a reform that in a way is associated to the market structure behind it. The previous government lacked the political capital to have this package of reform approved. And this is why, in the end, the plan was not flying and risked of being, let's say, not approved by the Brussels Authority. The hope is that now, with the new coalition forming behind Draghi, which is broader and apparently more eager to support the reform, because that government is raising precisely with that mandate of completing the vaccine plan and completing the recovery plan for Italy. These two things might happen, and therefore there might be a broader support for reforms in my country.
Thank you, Carlo. This is a very clear overview for a very complicated country, as you've been rightly hinting at, you know, all the roadblocks they are every time that you have one of these issues which are on the table, which seem, at least on the paper, quite seemingly easy to do, but then given the local circumstances, they are actually, you know, there is a lot of changes that are required and that require a political capital, as you mentioned. But we are going towards the end of these episodes. We don't have so much time, but I would still like to hear some final comments, not necessarily on the Italian case, but it could be as well some comments about what do we learn out of what has been going on in Italy. What do we learn for the future of the recovery plan, but what we learn as well for the future of the direction to go in this specific case. And of course, this is not going to be a conclusion whatsoever, because as I say, this is an ongoing conversation we are having since 1 year. We are going to continue to have this conversation here at Bruegel and beyond, because this is all as it is happening. So I would like to gather your final comments over there.
What is absolutely important, in my view, is that the EU recovery money is spent well. Carlo very rightly highlighted the many, many difficulties that Italy will likely face. And certainly it's not just for Italy. I mean, many other countries will struggle to find the good projects, the good programs, where to invest, what kind of reforms do in what sequencing. And certainly one important reason is that certainly when we provide common resources, then certainly there is a common European interest that this money will be spent well. But there is even, I would say, a more broader issue is that if there will be many failures, namely that some countries will do wasteful spending or too expensive spending due to corruption and other problems, then it could undermine the trust in common European projects. And in that case, this current recovery fund will be indeed just a one-time attempt, and all further efforts to build a stronger fiscal union would not likely to happen. So we'll have to keep our fingers crossed, first of all, for the countries to spend the money well, but also for the sake of a broader common European good, namely whether we will have similar programs or deeper fiscal integration in the future. I think the success of this recovery and resilience facility will have a major impact on that in the future.
Maria?
Yeah, I mean, first, let me just second everything that Zsolt just said, because I mean, I think that's absolutely crucial that we have a unique opportunity to demonstrate that common money that is put down by the European Union is being put to good use. And, you know, if that is not done in a way that is convincing for the citizens across the continent, then it's really going to jeopardize the credibility of the project. So I really like to emphasize that, because there is a lot at stake here than just the 750 billion that has been put on the table. Perhaps if I may look a little bit forward and say what are going to be the, on the fiscal side, what are going to be the big issues, also because this is also the week that we hear a lot about the new fiscal stimulus that the Biden administration is going to put. We know that this conversation will also come to Europe, and there will be questions asked as to whether there needs to be more fiscal stimulus. I mean, is this big enough? What do we need to do more? The 1.9 trillion that the Biden administration is suggested to put out as a support package is not so much a fiscal stimulus, it's still a support package. It really is much bigger than the EU Generation Fund. It's probably around double the size, I would argue. But of course, in Europe, we have the national responses. And as Zsolt talked about at the beginning, you need to add that up. So there is fiscal power that we have used. And, you know, we will probably need to use continuously, since the pandemic is not something that we're going to exit from very soon. I don't believe that the vaccination is going to be the liberation from the vaccine, given delays, given also the fact that at global level, we're not going to end the vaccination process for another 2 years. So I think till we are convincingly out of the process, there will be a need for policy intervention at the macro level, support, but also stimulus in various forms. In particular, as you know, Carlo said earlier on, as firms come out of this hibernation that we put them in artificially, we will have a better idea of who is productive and can stay, who's not productive and can go, but also correct for type 1 and type 2 errors that we'll be making inevitably around the process. So, you know, the state will continue to play a very important role there. My sense is that given that we will need that support for some time, it's important to pace ourselves because we will need it for some time. It's not a one-off thing and then cured. I think the fiscal positions of a number of countries in Europe is dangerous. And while it remains dangerous, the fiscal space conversation will come back. So on the one hand, we will need countries to do stuff. On the other hand, not everybody will have the power to do that. And the fiscal resources that are coming from European Union, they are what they are. So I would urge us to sort of make sure we put the money that we do have in good use, pace ourselves in terms of extra fiscal response that we need, as we have more information to adjust our policy responses, and then you know, make sure that first and foremost we deal with the pandemic before we do everything else.
Carlo?
Yeah, I agree totally with what Jose Maria have said in terms of the relevance at the EU level of the good use of the recovery funds. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for establishing a start of a serious fiscal union that otherwise will be gone probably for another generation if we are, let's say, not able to use properly these funds. For my country, which is clearly one among the highest and most exposed in terms of financial instability, because already the debt this year should peak at 160% over GDP, it is even more important to use the recovery plan. We have a number in mind. I mean, Italy has been growing at 0 point something for a number of years, and probably potential growth in Italy is below 1%. So we have in mind that over the next 2 or 3 years, these reforms I was mentioning before should increase the potential growth of Italy by at least 1 percentage point. If this is feasible, then given the current scenario in terms of interest rates, that level of debt becomes sustainable. And therefore, we can get out of the woods and grow out of the debt with a good use of the recovery fund. If we do not use the recovery money properly, then the fiscal position of my country becomes very, very dangerous, and with it, clearly, a risk of instability for the entire euro area. Thank God we have now at the helm, you know, a guy that has proven to be able to, let's say, run the ship in the midst of the storm. So we hope that this can be, in a way, a good omen for the future months.
And with this hopeful note, I would like to thank all our listeners for tuning in to The Sound of Economics, and to our guests, Carlo, Scholt and Maria. And I would like to remind you that the dataset of the fiscal response at national level that has been produced by Scholt and many other colleagues from Bruegel is accessible on our website www.bruegel.org, and that forthcoming in the next, I would say, weeks or month, there will be a new dataset that will give an overview of the national recovery plans in the frame of the Next Generation Europe at Bruegel. Thank you so much again, and until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.